From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this episode, we go to E3, where we see how the video game industry responds to questions about the lack of diversity.
Someone wrote to us and said it's so refreshing to see a character that's not, you know, this big muscle white man that we've got, you know, a kind of small, long-haired, brown-skinned, lanky leg character.
Carol Rosenberg talks about a stranger-than-usual week at Guantanamo Bay.
They have really reprogrammed their language down there in terms of survivalism.
And Ashim Ahluwalia, director of the film Miss Lovely, talks about the dark side of Bollywood's film industry and how some very naughty bits made it into Indian cinema.
I was very interested in these lower depths of the industry because it just seemed like no one was talking about this.
That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. From the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California, this is All Things Considered. I'm Arun Roth. This is E3, the Electronic Entertainment Expo, the video game industry's biggest convention. The old stereotype that gamers are all nerdy white men, well, there was truth to that. A survey 9 years ago found that 83% of the people making video games were white men. And the vast majority of college students studying computer science and video game art are men. Even today, a Kaiser Family Foundation study found that nearly 9 out of every 10 video game protagonists are white men. But in recent years, some in the industry say things are really changing, that interactive games incorporate sophisticated narratives like never before, that games are now directed at and are being played by a much more diverse group, no longer the domain of the nerdy white guy. So we came to this showcase of what the gaming world has in store to see how the industry is going to deliver on those promises. That's our cover story today. E3 is massive and bright and colorful and loud. Sensory overload doesn't quite cover it. In spite of all the noise and spectacle, none of the new games here seemed that new. A lot of sequels. Assassin's Creed, Call of Duty, Mario Kart, a repackaging of Halo, and lots of ultra-violence. The most exciting place at E3 was actually the quietest, a room above the crowded convention floor. Here they're demonstrating a game about as far as you can get from a first-person shooter. It's called Adrift, and it's being developed for the virtual reality platform Oculus Rift. You may have heard of Oculus Rift. They were recently acquired in a huge deal by Facebook. I have the chance to try on the goggles that Mark Zuckerberg was willing to pay $2 billion for.
Cool. So, yeah, when you pop this on, you'll find yourself in the game world environment. Basically, have a look around, get your bearings.
And I am in outer space.
Have a good look down at your feet.
Oh, my.
I'm an astronaut floating in a spaceship or space station that's been damaged. All I can hear is my breathing and Beethoven's Pathétique Sonata.
There's the Earth. There's Mexico right below me.
It's incredible, unlike any VR headset I've tried. My brain is processing the input like it's real sense data.
It's really amazing. I actually feel a bit of vertigo.
Adam Orth is the creator of Adrift.
The goal of the game is to A, survive, and B, get home safely.
Honestly, I don't care about the goal of the game. I was just so excited to be in outer space. I could happily spend hours just exploring the environment. But here's the weirdest part of the experience. I had this deeply emotional feeling of being transported, an intensity I'd never felt before in a game. Orth says he wants to harness that emotion to take gamers beyond the standard violent action games.
And there's nothing wrong with those games. They're great. And I love them, and I've made them, and I play them. But I don't want to make them anymore, and I want to tell emotional stories, and that device is allowing me to tell them in a way that I was not able to do it before.
It's kind of a buzzkill to go back to the convention floor. The noise of firearms and explosions. Mostly white male attendees playing almost entirely white male characters. Okmanesh writes for Polygon, a gaming news site.
To the outside world, video games are violence and men doing that violence. And I think that that's a really good way to push anybody out that would be interested in it.
Past E3 press conferences have been roundly criticized for the lack of diversity. This year, out of dozens of presenters, there were 5 women and 3 people of color. An improvement, to be sure, but not great. One Polygon headline announced that during the big press conferences, there were more severed heads in game demos than female presenters.
I think it's getting a little bit better in recent years because people are finally starting to pay attention to it and starting to make it a big deal where it hasn't been so much before.
And the tradition of booth babes, the hot models who draw attendees to displays, that's dying out. None of the major companies have them anymore. Women make up nearly half of video gamers, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation study. But that covers not just console games like Call of Duty, but social games like Farmville on Facebook, and mobile games like Candy Crush. Looking around at E3, it's tough to imagine that console players are really half women. Polygon's managing editor, Justin McElroy, says the current system is self-perpetuating.
Dudes are playing video games, dudes are making video games, dudes are putting dudes in the games for the dudes to play. Anything that goes against that is going to be work.
But some independent companies are taking on that hard work, like the Spanish game studio Tequila Works.
I'd say that our studio is a bit different.
Risa Cohen is the executive producer for Tequila Works.
I'd say for the last 20 years that I've been working in video games, it has been pretty white and pretty male.
Raul Rubio is CEO and creative director at the company.
We have, for example, 11 nationalities here, 4 sexual orientations, and 3 different religions.
Together, Raul and Risa have loaded Tequila Works with top-level talent, like their lead animator, a woman with serious chops from LucasArts and Pixar. Right now, they're working on a game called Rhyme. Like the last game I tried, you start off in Rhyme trying to make sense of and survive a bewildering situation. In this case, washing ashore on a mysterious desert island. But this isn't virtual reality, and you see the character you're portraying. It's a striking contrast to any video game hero I've seen before. This one is a child, maybe 8 or 9. You can't tell if it's a boy or girl. Long black hair and brown skin. Again, Risa Cohen.
Someone wrote to us and said it's so refreshing to see a character that's not, you know, this big muscle white man, that we've got, you know, a kind of small, long-haired, brown-skinned, lanky leg character.
Raul says people were entranced by the promise of a game that bucks the trend of violence.
This is a game with no combat at all. This is not about the shooting. Quite the opposite. It's about discovering and feeling that all things can look new and mysterious.
There's no set release date for Rhyme or for the Oculus Rift platform. So the revolution in video games may be coming just a little later than advertised. It's time now for the latest installment of our series, My Big Break, about triumphs, big and small. You know Michael Kenneth Williams as Chalky White on HBO's Boardwalk Empire, or stick-up man Omar Little on The Wire. But before Williams was an actor, he was a dancer in music videos starring artists like Madonna and George Michael.
I was doing a bunch of videos, just dancing background. But then on my birthday, on my 25th birthday, I got cut in my face in a barroom brawl. There was a popping party going on in Queens. Went outside to get some air, and I saw that two of my other friends was being surrounded by some dudes who I didn't know. And it looked like they were about to get jumped. And I said, yo, I'm ready to leave. Let's go back. I'm going to go back home now. But this one dude kept pacing behind me. He kept walking behind me. He kept like, psst, like, you know, like sucking his teeth. And I'm looking, I'm like, yo, what's up, dude? I'm like, yo, bro, what's your problem? And the dude wiped his hand across his mouth and just what I thought it appeared to be smacked me. But what he did was he spit a razor. He was positioning the razor in his mouth to get it between his middle finger and his ring finger. And then he just went wiped me down my face. And this cut in my face was actually the first hit of the fight. So we managed to escape with our lives barely that night. Things changed immediately after that. Directors didn't want me just to dance in the videos anymore. They wanted me to act out these thug roles. You know, I was like, you know, Mike, roll these dice in this video. Have this fight in this video. I was like, all right. Tupac Shakur was filming a movie in New York called Bullet, opposite Mickey Rourke. And the production office that they were working out of in New York happened to have a Polaroid picture of me from me going to audition from some various music video. So he happened to see a Polaroid picture of me and was like, yo, this dude looks thugged out enough that he could play my little brother. I think he saw my pain, my struggle, my heart. I was just like, I was starstruck, you know? I was like, wow, it's Tupac's core.
And if you was half as smart as I thought you was, Patty boy, you'd be minding your business right now.
I tell you, we know all about your little hotshot package.
Tupac was larger than life. I spent a lot of time just listening to him and watching him because I learned so much. He's that kind of person. It's like a walking encyclopedia. I shot that movie, still dancing, and I had booked a major supporting role on Law & Order. I had booked a major supporting role on Sopranos. So, you know, I got a little high on the horse, you know. Yeah, I ain't going to L.A. L.A. going to send for me, you know what I mean? So I'm like, my phone will be ringing any minute now. And it didn't happen. And I got really financially strapped. My mom opened up a daycare in the projects where we lived. So in 2000, she was like, why don't you come work in the daycare? You know, I'm paying your rent anyway. You might as well earn it. So I said, Ma, you know, I want to give this acting thing one more shot. It doesn't work. I'm done. It's me and you. We changing Pampers, baby. My phone did not ring. And, man, I was down in the dumps. I got really depressed, like really depressed. And then March came, and one day she called me and said, you got a fax downstairs here. I went downstairs to her office, and it was the breakdown for Omar from The Wire on HBO.
State your name for the record.
Omar Devone Little.
And what is your occupation?
I rip and run.
You?
I robs drug dealers.
Mr. Little, how does a man rob drug dealers for 8 or 9 years and live to tell about it?
Day to time, I suppose.
I got to grow with an amazing group of people that I consider my Wire family. That character changed my life. And that was my big break.
That's actor Michael Kenneth Williams. We want to hear about your big break. Send us an email at mybigbreak@npr.org. Once again, you're listening to All Things Considered. I'm Arun Roth. If I say Indian movies, I bet right away you think about the Bollywood musical. You know, those lavish, beautiful productions that last as long as a German opera and feature singing and dancing that manages to be sexy and chaste at the same time. Well, I want to introduce you to an Indian production that will turn your expectations inside out. In his new feature, Miss Lovely, director Ashim Ahluwalia exposes Bollywood's sordid underbelly.
We brag about making 900 films a year, but what most people don't realize is that about 750 of those films, especially up to the late 90s, were C-grade films, sex horror or bandit films that were essentially sexually explicit. And I was very interested in these lower depths of the industry because it just seemed like no one was talking about this.
Miss Lovely follows two brothers who produce softcore porn in the 1980s, shooting in one-hour hotels and racing to keep one step ahead of the cops who would shut them down. Ashim Ahluwalia initially wanted to make a documentary about this part of the industry.
I spent about a year and a half trying to research that, really got access to a space that I think very few people knew about. What unfortunately happened is that after a year and a half of doing this research, nobody really wanted to be on camera because it's illegal. And you know, it's me being quite naive about the repercussions of this. Pornography in India, it's a minimum of 3 years in jail. It's non-bailable. Mainstream films barely show a kiss on screen. So the fact that these people were making pornographic films, nobody felt comfortable to actually appear and tell me the same stories that they were telling me the night before when we were drinking in a bar. What I did was essentially take this stuff and put it in a semi-fictional form, set it in the mid-80s, just to protect the identities of the people who told me these stories. So all that material kind of worked its way back, and that became the basis of the script for Miss Lovely.
And in terms of the film, how Miss Lovely looks, it's got a very kind of verite feel. It almost feels like a documentary.
Yeah, the irony is that a lot of the industry people that refuse to be in my documentary When I was ready to make the fiction film, they were more than happy to play themselves, you know, and they said, oh, this is a real movie. This is fine. We'll do this. And what that brought was a real authenticity to the project.
Yeah, and even deeper than that, with that authenticity, there's a quality to this film. I almost wonder, was this shot on film stock from the time? It seems like it was actually produced in the 80s.
You know, in the 80s, we didn't have Kodak film stock in India. We had a very socialist stock that we made called Indu, and it had a very particular look. And I was really trying to look for that feeling, that sort of texture that the stock brought. What we did was we used a lot of expired film stock and shot on that. So it had a kind of murky quality, but at the same time, really helps in making it as immersive as it is.
You mentioned these films are illegal. They're not like there were exploitation films in America, but they didn't have the police raiding them the way that they did in India. How did they keep going?
What they would do is that they would make a film which would be, say, 2 hours long. It would be a horror film or it would be a bandit film. What most people didn't realize is that when they were shooting the feature, they were also shooting what was called the bits reels, these pornographic sections.
Naughty bits.
The naughty bits, but they were pretty naughty. And the thing is that they would hold these back, send the film, the rest of the film, to the censors, which would have nothing in it. And then when that stuff came back, these bits reels would be interspersed directly into the film in the projection booth.
Hmm. So in spite of the subject matter we've been discussing, this film has got past the censor board in India. Did you splice out the naughty bits?
The first thing when we submitted it to the censors, when the distributor submitted this to the censors, the first question they asked is, are you sure you want to go through with this process? To be honest, I never thought it would ever release in India. I just thought it's an interesting exercise for me to see what they asked me to cut. The first round, they asked me to make 157 cuts. The amazing thing is that there's a loophole in the Indian censorship law, which means that you can keep reviewing a film endlessly. And most people, because of commercial considerations, when they make a film, they already have a preset release date. So then they have to kind of take whatever's, you know, been offered by the censor board and then cut those bits. But myself, I didn't have a release schedule. I just kept going back. And I went back about 4 or 5 times over the course of a year. I turned into a sort of very persuasive, almost irritating sort of lawyer figure. And I just kept going back. I think that the thing that nailed it was that I said that the film is really very much about women. The women get out in the end. They don't allow themselves to be dominated by the men. You never see this in Hindi cinema. And one of the women on the board said that she felt that that was true. And that really switched the whole thing in our favor. So we did get through with very few cuts, some blurs, and the film released in 400 cinemas in India, and it was kind of incredible.
And given the ways in which you're breaking convention, how has it been received in India?
You know, it had already been to Cannes, it was in Toronto, it was in Rotterdam, so it had already gone out. And sometimes Indians can get quite upset if you are seen to be showing the bad side of India to the global public. And I was actually quite frightened when the film came out, and I was really, really pleasantly surprised at the support we got. We got incredible reviews. There was a real rallying behind the film, and there was a lot of people discussing that, you know, the box office, we were the most popular film that week, which is, you know, it still blows my mind, actually.
Ashim Ahluwalia is the director of the film Miss Lovely, which is out now in New York and Los Angeles and other select theaters. He joined me from our studios in New York. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Arun. Thank you.
Again, it's All Things Considered from NPR West. I'm Arun Roth. Deadheads. Grateful Dead fans, for you youngsters, used to follow their favorite band from city to city with a cult-like devotion. People used to say it was the kind of scene you just couldn't replicate with another band. Then came Phish. The Vermont-based band enjoyed a similar cult following throughout the 1990s. Then, in 2004, an abrupt halt. A press statement from the band said, "They're done." It took 5 years before Phish would be ready to climb back on a stage together. One of the most reliable and workmanlike touring bands of the 90s has become more of a rarity these days. So for fans, every new album is a treat. And for their latest, coming out on Tuesday, Phish even recruited Pink Floyd's producer, Bob Ezrin, to tweak the knobs for them. The new album by Phish is called Fuego. It's dawning on me how it starts. Your wisdom must be wise ones. Some lost, some has many parts. Sing, sing, Monica, sing your song. It really didn't last too long. I spoke with keyboardist Paige McConnell and guitarist Trey Anastasio, and I asked them when they knew it was time to make a new album.
Interestingly, we started with a genuine desire to just hang out together. So we actually, Paige, you'll remember this probably, but we told everyone in our management and people around us, we're not making a record, we're not making a record. Don't ask us to deliver you anything, you know. We just wanted to get together. And, you know, we used to live together in a couple of houses when we were young, and we spent so much time together. And then we traveled on a bus together. That aspect of being in a band has become harder with our families to, you know, it's been harder to find that time with just the four of us. And so we went into the barn and just locked the door.
Now, this is the famous barn in Vermont where you guys get together and jam and where a lot of the magic happens, right?
Yeah, and a lot of long meals and sunny afternoons with the doors open. It's beautiful up there. It's right on a hillside. And I just absolutely love those times as much as any other part of being in the band.
So you guys were just going to get together, and we're just going to hang out. It's not going to be about music, but the music came.
We wanted to hang out, and I think the other desire was we're not talking about an album. Let's just see if the four of us can write songs together in a way that we hadn't before, or in a way that we might have just barely scratched the surface but not really completely embraced.
Well, let's talk through that process with one of the songs, and probably Fuego, the title track. It's the first song on the album. It's probably a good one to start because it's the longest, probably the most complicated in terms of composition.
I was going to say one thing, and then Paige, you tell the story. But one of the things that we did that was so funny, and we'll use Fuego as an example, is that we would sometimes pull up a picture, a photo. We said, let's take a photo of someone, and we'll write about this guy or this gal. And so we found this photo online of this, I don't know, it was like almost like a cosplay kind of thing. Somebody leaning on a tree with this weird costume on. Paige, you can tell
the rest goth,
of the story.
Very goth.
Like
and
goth.
I think it was a girl.
I think it was a girl.
It's sort of hard to tell. It had sort of a an asymmetrical haircut that was jet black and sort of swept across her face. And she had sort of this little skull of like a little animal on her belt. And she was carrying a sword and leaning against a tree. And she sort of looked like a Viking warrior or something like that. And so part of the lyrics were inspired by her, and then part of the lyrics were inspired by coffee mugs.
All of a sudden, the song makes sense.
Yeah.
We would start debating, but, you know, it took on a whole life of its own, that suddenly we knew who this person was, and everybody's kind of chiming on what the story was, and we write about it. It kept morphing, though.
Guys sit down in the barn, you put up that picture and say, let's just play that?
We did a writing exercise. We each had a pad and we had a timer on it. And everybody said, you know, look at this photo and write for, was it 5 minutes, Paige?
5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, and the bell would go off, bing. And then each person would read to the other three what they had written. And if there were certain lines that the other three really resonated with the other three, we would put them on a fifth pad until they were all intermingled and we couldn't remember who had written what. And then we kind of work from that pad to start forming out the lyrics.
I'm a sailor's girl, the best is yet to come. Rolling in my fuego, I do my own stunts. I see guilty people, angels blowing horns.
A lot of stuff got tossed aside, too, that were, I'm remembering, Paige, that we, like, we spent a long time working on this song about a chance meeting at a 7-Eleven. And then when Bob Ezrin got there, he came much later in the process. He kind of walked in, and we had 28 songs, and he kind of pointed at 12 that he wanted to work on very quickly.
More than 28 songs. It was closer to 40, I believe, that we had on the list there. And within the first hour of being there, he cut it down to about 14.
He said, play me everything and don't tell me who wrote it. We said, okay. We started playing him. He'd start a song and go about 45 seconds into it and say, nope, next. And then he'd play another one and he'd say, yep. And within about, like Paige said, within about half an hour, it was down to 14 songs.
Bob Ezrin is really, you know, if you're a rock and roll fan, a legendary record producer. You know, produced The Wall, produced Berlin by Lou Reed. Could you give us an example, like with one of the songs, like what are some ways in which we could hear the Ezrin fingerprints on the production?
The one for me that I thought was a really nice moment on the album, the last song is Wingsuit, and right before it goes into sort of this outro jam guitar solo, there's a little bit of a break and just a little bit of a maybe some backwards vocals or something here very faintly in the background. That to me was something that he addressed, that little transition and sort of made it special, and that's one of my favorite parts of the record.
It's funny you mentioned that one, because on that track, isn't that where Trey, there's a little reference to Pink Floyd on that song, right? Sounds like Comfortably Numb.
That wasn't a conscious effort, but I definitely agree with you. And and I was joking about that with someone, and I said, if it sounds like Pink Floyd, record it.
Fish has this tradition, you guys have been doing it for a while, where once a year, I think it's a Halloween show, you'll play a concert where you do another band's album all the way through. This year you didn't, because you did the new album, Fuego. I'm curious if there's something you've been dreaming about doing that you haven't performed yet.
You learn a lot from learning these other albums. I mean, we did Remain in Light by the Talking Heads one year, and we did Exile on Main Street, and we did a Velvet Underground album, but I think everybody kind of got a little sick of it, to be perfectly honest. So the last couple of years, it started to feel like a trap we had built.
I think in a lot of ways, I think doing our own album was a little bit of a liberating experience for me. I kind of wonder if maybe we'll look to start a new tradition.
That's Paige McConnell and Trey Anastasio of Fish. Their new album called Fuego comes out on Tuesday. Trey, Paige, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And for a few more days, you can stream Fuego in its entirety at nprmusic.org.
Up all night and I'm waiting for you to come home. Waiting all night. Waiting all night. My mind is racing and I'm wondering what I did wrong.
We're going to take you now inside of one of the busiest emergency rooms in the United States. The Los Angeles County USC Medical Center, commonly known as LA County Hospital.
Hold on, hold CPR, hold CPR. He's gonna cut it. Does he have a pulse?
They'll see the worst of the worst when it comes to human trauma. Car wrecks, gunshot wounds, and they have to race the clock to save victims from otherwise certain death. The place is the subject of a new documentary called Code Black. Ryan McGarry directed the film. He's an ER doc himself and trained at County Hospital. He vividly remembers the first time he visited the ER there.
I couldn't believe the amount of volume and the amount of perceived chaos.
Is it in? Is the TV?
Yeah, it's in. Call RT.
Okay, this isn't very good. What happened?
And yet, underneath that chaos was a very well-functioning machine of resuscitation, both for critical illness as well as trauma.
We are going to care of you, okay? Just relax a little bit, okay?
This hurt here on your leg?
When McGarry started filming, the hospital was in a facility built in the 1930s, and at the center of the emergency room was a tiny and chaotic area reserved for the most critical patients. It was called C Booth. As one doctor says in the film, more people have died in that small square footage than anywhere else in the country. But more people have also been saved there than anywhere else. McGarry explained what made C Booth so legendary.
L.A. County Hospital is one of the first places that emergency medicine was formed as a specialty. And it's important to recognize that emergency medicine, as is 911, are actually fairly young. I mean, these are 1960s, 1970s developments in this country. And so this is where it's thought the specialty was born. And C Booth, which it's been lost to history, but we think that means either critical booth or cardiac booth, is kind of where the sickest patients would come. And as a training physician, it's where you would oversee up to 6 or 7 or even more of these critically ill patients.
And the types of cases that you're seeing at County Hospital, aside from like the trauma cases, there's a type of patient that comes there because you don't turn anyone away.
That's right. So even post-Obamacare, we're seeing throughout the country emergency room visits go up. And that might be counterintuitive, but what we're finding is that, yes, more people have access, more people are getting insurance cards, but those cards aren't always premium. And we're already in a system where a lot of specialists won't take a sub-premium insurance card because you're not seen as profitable enough. So many people end up coming to public hospital emergency departments just to see an orthopedist or endocrinologist or someone who won't take their probably decent insurance, but it's not good enough.
Now, you are there to film a major shift. L.A. County Hospital underwent a renovation in 2008, and they moved to a new earthquake-resistant building. You wouldn't think it would be so dramatic a change because they're basically moving almost across the street to a new facility. It's the same people, but things change dramatically. Can you explain what happened?
They moved from a historic landmark building to what's probably one of the most impressive, technologically laden medical facilities in the country. It was a $1 billion structure, and it's packed with absolutely incredible features. But what was lost along the way is not so much a reflection of the LA County's decision to move from one building to another, but really a perfect encapsulation of what modern healthcare has become. And it's kind of become depersonalized as a result of a lot of well-intentioned features, whether that be safety regulations or privacy regulations or even a lot of technology. I mean, think about it. The last time you went to the physician or even a nurse practitioner's office, probably a computer and a screen and a lot of charting, right, was probably the mainstay of that experience.
I just had a patient with the simplest of complaints. It took me about 2 minutes to see her. And what turns into a very simple complaint, there's just tons of things to have to do in terms of documentation. And basically, it took me 4 times as long to document as it took for me to talk to her and do the exam at the same time.
That didn't happen at the old place because it was just so open and intimate.
You yourself say this is well-intentioned stuff. It's about, trying to protect the patient in different ways. Do you see any way through to, like, make a balance here?
I think the major responsibility here is actually on the physicians. I think that we have to speak up, and probably most docs feel like we have lost control over this, or at least our voice. You know, oftentimes we're the most invested in the patient care, right? I'm $300,000 in debt. I lost every weekend of my 20s to becoming a physician. And yet I'm the last one who decides what that patient-doctor experience is going to be like. That's now decided by everyone from politicians, insurance companies, to people who got their, MBAs online or something. And I've invested so much into this idea of the patient-doctor experience, and yet I'm the last one to really get to say how that experience is going to go. So really, I think the answer is docs have to speak up. And I think partly that's what Code Black was for me personally, was a chance to say, okay, this is a state of affairs, and I don't think that we feel like it's acceptable.
That was Ryan McGarry. He's an ER doctor and the director of the new documentary, Code Black. From the studios of NPR West in Culver City, California, this is All Things Considered. I'm Arun Roth. Back in April of 2012, I saw the self-proclaimed architect of the 9/11 attacks as he was arraigned before a military commission in Guantanamo. It was the start of the government's third attempt to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. After the military commissions under President Bush were ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, President Obama's effort to try Mohammed in a federal court in New York City fell apart. The Obama administration reformed the military commissions and restarted the prosecution, but it is moving very slowly. The actual trial still hasn't started, as the court works to resolve big issues, like the admissibility of evidence from the CIA black sites where Mohammed was waterboarded. Carol Rosenberg of the Miami Herald just returned from the latest hearings at Guantanamo. She says it was a strange week.
In a way, it feels less and less like it's about the 9/11 trial and the events of 9/11 than it did during the arraignment 2 years ago. No mention of what happened on September 11th in this very short half-hour hearing. And this time they didn't even bring down 9/11 victims because they knew it was going to be pretty much in the weeds of this latest conflict question over whether the FBI approaching detainees' legal teams was compromising the defense's ability to do the case.
While the 9/11 hearings drag on, a brand new military commission was started this week to try Abd al-Hadi al-Iraqi on war crimes charges. He's an Iraqi who went to Afghanistan and fought with the Taliban and has been in U.S. custody since 2006. Rosenberg says this new trial marks a change in approach for the Guantanamo prosecutors.
They're looking at it as more like traditional war crimes. It seems like they want to expand the reach of the military commissions beyond what they had seen sort of as terrorism. And he's the first one in that they're not trying to do a death penalty trial for. If convicted, he gets life.
Also in Guantanamo this week, reporters got their first look at the prison after a 200-day media blackout that coincided with a hunger strike at the facility. But Rosenberg says there have been language and procedural changes that reflect what she calls a new survivalist mentality. Guards now refer to prisoners as the enemy, even though more than half of the 149 men held there have been cleared for release.
They've renamed a security post a fighting position. They've got the seaside galley they're now calling Camp America. We're like more than a year plus into a hunger strike, and now they're calling it long-term non-religious fast days. The idea is to portray it all as in the past and not happening. Effectively, it's been working, with the exception of last week, right? Because after the release of the Taliban Five, all the reporters came running down and started asking the same questions all over again.
Carol Rosenberg reports on Guantanamo for the Miami Herald. The vibraphone. It's a special instrument. That spooky, smoky, sparkling sound. There's nothing like it. And there's nothing like hearing the vibes played by Bobby Hutcherson. He's covered a lot of ground on his instrument. In the 1950s, as a teenager, he was already playing professional gigs. In the 60s, he was a leading light of jazz's avant-garde, breaking new ground on some of the most revered LPs issued by Blue Note Records. Now 73 years old, Bobby Hutcherson has a new album, Enjoy the View, and he's back with Blue Note. His history with the label goes back to his landmark 1965 debut as a bandleader, Dialogue. The radical music on that album both thrilled and infuriated jazz fans, but Hutcherson told me the sound came almost naturally from the New York jazz scene of the 1960s.
In New York, you know, there was a big influx of new musicians, you know, there was a lot of history being presented at that time. I mean, you could stop on the street corner and hear Malcolm X, you know.
That's why it has this kind of revolutionary sort of feeling to it.
Yeah, well, you know, there was the revolution that was going on, you know, the Black Panthers. There was a lot of riots and things going on. There was an awful lot of things going on for the music to describe, you know. Because at that time, the music was almost like a newspaper of what was going on in the streets. And then at that time also, a lot of the musicians didn't have what was called a cabaret card. which was a card to be able to play in all the famous nightclubs. So everybody played in the lofts that they lived in. Everybody would be standing around waiting to play. You know, those things don't happen anymore, you know, where there's this huge jam session where everybody's waiting to play and everybody's sharing ideas and thoughts. Everybody's listening to the music that they wrote, describing what was going on in the streets.
So skipping ahead more than a couple of decades to the new album, it's called Enjoy the View, and you're playing with, you got Joey DeFrancesco on organ. One of the tunes on here, Teddy, is a tune that you've played in the past. Why is it you two play so well together?
Joey knows how to let the organ surround the vibraphone without overstating it or without drowning it out. He embraces the instrument. He knows how to make the two instruments sound somewhat the same.
Another tune on the new album, Hey Harold, that's a tune that you wrote over 40 years ago. And I never heard this officially, but I'm assuming that's a shout out to Harold Land, the great saxophonist you were working with at the time.
Yeah, you know, I've always loved Harold so much. I always wish that he would have got the command and respect from a lot of people that he really deserved. He could play a note and you could say, ooh, that's Harold Land right away.
Having written that tune with Harold Land in mind, what's it like now that he's passed, to hear David Sanborn playing the tune?
Just because of the tune, it can cause different memories to come up where you say, hey, I remember playing like this, or hey, I remember feeling this thought. You know, I remember what it felt like when the sun hit me and it was hot and sweat rolled down my face. How it felt having that piece of apple cobbler with some ice cream on it, and the ice cream was dripping down the side of the cup. A little bit of it dripped out the corner of your mouth. Ooh, boy.
You're making me hungry.
I'm gonna have to go get some cobbler after that. I just described that was so good. I want some myself.
Me too. Ask you to tell, this is kind of a random story, but it's this funny story that I read about. You had kind of an interesting introduction to playing the electric vibes. I think this is in Italy. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. Harold and I were playing, one of the first gigs we had was us playing in Verona. And the Deacon Company had just given me this electric vibe. So as we were walking to the sound check, Harold and I looked up and I saw a big puff of black smoke over the stage. I said, wow, I wonder what that is, Harold. And as we walked up to the stage, the electricians and the sound men, you know, they're saying to me, they said, oh, Bobby, we were so sorry. We forgot your 110 and we hooked your 110 up to 220. And it's
higher voltage for Europe.
Yes, then we got a fire here. He said, but we put the fire out. And forget the sound check. We're going to fix your instrument so that it'll work and make sure that everything's fine. Just come back for the concert. So we went back to the hotel, and then we come back that night. And in those days, I was always full of pranks. And so Harold turns to me, and he says, Bobby, he says, this is a really important concert. He says, no pranks, okay? Just let's just play the music. I said, don't worry. You can count on me. So sound man says, ladies and gentlemen, the Bobby Hutcherson Harold Land Quintet. And he opens the curtain. They plug the instrument in, and the biggest spark of electricity and a huge puff of black smoke goes off. Well, they thought that it was part of the act, and they all went crazy. The crowd went crazy. And Harold turns to me, he says, "You said you wouldn't do anything."
That's vibraphonist Bobby Hutcherson. His new album is called Enjoy the View. Bobby, it's been a thrill speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Harvey.
For the week ending June 22nd, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Becky Sullivan, Stephen Jackson, and Daniel Hajek. Our intern is Jen Velez. Patrick Murray is our technical director with technical support from Leo Delagula. Muthoni Muturi is our senior editor and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.